This program is a theoretical account for the events that occurred on and after July the 2nd, 1937. Although she was declared dead in absentia on January the 5th, 1939, there are many that believe that the case of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan remains unsolved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. Normally, I start each part of the show by telling you where I'm at. Tonight, I just can't do that. My location has to remain unknown except for this. I'm somewhere in the Northwest. A tease, I know. But I had to make a promise to the people that let me come here that for now, it would remain anonymous. In the first four parts of this series, we've covered a lot of ground. And I've promised you all that all of this information we've covered is going to tie in. Tonight it starts to do just that. In just a few short years, Amelia Earhart has become a household name. She's reached the zenith of her popularity, and at this point, she's nearly at icon status. That's arguable. In 1935, just under 2 short years before she would vanish into thin air, she began an unlikely partnership with Purdue University. This was an aspect of her life that she had been waiting for a long time. A chance to get in on the ground floor and directly influence the women of the time. A.E. relished her short time there, and as we'll learn tonight, she looked forward to expanding that role when she returned from the world flight. Tonight we take you back to 1935 in West Lafayette, Indiana, to discuss the start of something new for Amelia Earhart. Something she started that, unfortunately for her and us, was never finished. As we travel back to Purdue to discuss Amelia's short but powerful tenure there, I thought it'd be a great idea to start our journey tonight by speaking with someone that was in on the trenches, so to speak, when it came to life on campus. Luckily, I found the perfect guy, and he has more than one connection to Amelia Earhart.
My dad graduated from Atchison High School. My grandfather's lived there since probably the late 50s, early 1960s. He still lives there. He founded the Amelia Earhart Century Ride, owns a bike store now, but he taught auto mechanics and shop at Atchison High School.
It's not often on this show that we talk to a guest that ties to two areas of AE's life, but Andrew is that guy. Currently a visiting assistant professor of history at Texas A&M University, Andrew earned his PhD in American history at Purdue University, and he holds master's degrees from the University of Nevada and Baker University. That ties him to tonight's episode. But as you just heard, he has ties to Atchison, Kansas as well, Earhart country. He's the perfect person to introduce us to campus culture at Purdue pertaining to AE's influence there. And he had plenty of insight to get us started tonight.
Most of my childhood, we visited my grandfather living in Atchison. I remember driving by Amelia Earhart's house in Atchison, learning about her in the sort of local county museum there downtown. It has a lot of railroad cars too, but I remember seeing stuff about her And so she's always been one of those figures that's been very close to, you know, childhood experiences with my grandfather and both bike racing and riding and visiting him at Atchison.
What I really love about Andrew's connection to Amelia is the idea that after coming to Purdue, he decided to educate himself on her time there. As he teaches and molds, much like Amelia did when she was there, he too was learning more about the woman that carries such a massive influence over the university that he was employed at.
I didn't know much about her at all in terms of what she did at Purdue. I mean, I knew about her and her sort of disappearance. I knew that she came from Atchison, but I didn't have much of an understanding of her life or her journey or what she did beyond, you know, just sort of being famous for disappearing and being an early female aviator. So when I got to Purdue, it was really interesting to see, you know, there's a dorm named after her. There's a statue outside the dorm. They have a great collection of her documents. And so it sort of brought my life full circle. I went to Purdue in the fall of 2011 after living in a variety of different places. I had lived in Kansas. And I'd never personally lived in Atchison. There's sort of been a family connection. So coming to Purdue for me was a whole new learning experience about another side of Amelia that I didn't know, even though I thought I knew, you know, quite a bit about her from my childhood. And so I sort of learned alongside students about what she had done. And I, you know, tried to do what I could to read about her in the yearbooks and in the archives to get a sense of who this woman was and how she sort of represented like an early moment in American history in terms of female education and movement into industry and sort of exciting paths that we don't really think about women have opportunities to do that early on.
That begs the question, though. What does the student body think of Amelia Earhart today? Surely not everyone automatically knows about her connection to the university in the years before her disappearance. And Andrew filled me in.
Some of them have no idea what she did there. A lot of them are just as ignorant as I was when they arrive at Purdue. They see her name. They see the dorm and the statue. And they're like, okay, this is the woman who disappeared. What's her Purdue connection? And so a lot of them have questions. They're sort of curious about her immediately because they're like, okay, why here? Why now? And so they get really excited, particularly the female students. Purdue is a very large STEM university. They have a lot of students who are interested in engineering. They have their own airport. And so Purdue has those students, and part of their direction is connecting them to that history to sort of say, hey, you're not the first person to come here. This path is here. We've had major individuals sort of come out of our university and work here. And so a lot of what I see at Purdue in terms of the faculty admin is sort of getting her name as part of that recruitment retention of female STEM students. But I see it on the other side from the students that they feel empowered by having that connection with her. And it sort of makes Purdue that much more unique, that much more of a special place. And if you talk to any Purdue alum, they are really obsessive. They really love Purdue and the Purdue experience. And so she just sort of solidifies that for so many of them.
Go back and listen to that last part again. Did you catch it? It's no secret that Purdue is a staple in the STEM community. But the fact that Amelia Earhart is being used in the recruitment of female students into their modern-day STEM programs makes me beam with pride. We've been saying around here for a long time that Amelia Earhart was a pioneer in STEM. She was doing it before it was ever a thing. Purdue gave her the platform then, and they're spreading that word now. And I couldn't agree more. Since Andrew spent his time there on the ground floor teaching and discussing AE with the students, the obvious question about impact and legacy there had to be asked. Just what is Amelia's legacy there?
Well, I think it's a tricky question to answer. A lot of this is my personal opinion, but I think Purdue has come late to history and to sort of understanding and celebrating its history. Right now, they're celebrating their sesquicentennial, which is their 150th anniversary. And so they're doing a lot to sort of say, hey, look, this is where we've come from. This is who we are. This is our legacy. And she's a huge part of that. And so I think her legacy has really helped Purdue discover and rediscover itself over periods of time. Purdue is, you know, 60-40 male, so they've had a lot of problems recruiting, retaining, and focusing on women in higher education and in STEM. And that's not just a Purdue issue, that's an American issue. And so I think as Purdue sort of trying to be self-reflective and trying to understand itself and overcome some of those, you know, sort of problems with gender, they really look to her and look to her legacy. And so I think she's helped Purdue in that sense. And I think her legacy at Purdue has been like, wait a minute, we can do this. We've done this before. We've always tried to do this. And it's part of who we are as a mission. And so I think discovering and rediscovering her legacy and celebrating her legacy has helped Purdue sort of become reflective of those issues. Most Americans, I don't think, know about the Purdue story of her career. Some do if they're really big Amelia Earhart fans, but I don't think Purdue has done a great job of sort of positioning itself as central to the narrative. And it's not that that might be somewhat intentional. Like the Amelia Earhart story isn't a story about Purdue, it's about her. They are facilitating that. And I think their role in collecting and maintaining her collections with having all of her papers and funding, you know, her airplane and buying that for her, I think there's a lot of really cool stuff that could be further explored and publicized. But I think in terms of its legacy, I'm not sure they're recognized for having the collection and the rich legacy that they do in terms of her involvement there. And I'd like to see more of that. So her legacy, I think, looms larger than Purdue's legacy in that regard. Purdue has the legacy there, and her legacy at Purdue is great. But I think in terms of having faculty and student engagement, I would like to see Purdue put together some sort of publication. I mean, the documentary that you're doing and the podcast you're doing is great. But to see something more cohesive, something more tangible, like a publication or an article, something where they could say, hey, this is the history of Amelia Earhart at Purdue. I think there's so much stuff there that we haven't put together a document that you can take into the classroom or take to the public and say, here, read about this. This is, you know, women in STEM in the 1930s, or this is, you know, Amelia Earhart in education or women. And so there's a lot of these issues that we could address with a document that would make it really easy for us to teach. So I'm thinking this from a teaching perspective, but also from a general public perspective to say, oh, wow, this is a whole other side of Amelia Earhart that nobody really knows about. And so I think there's a lot more they could do to make that story told. And I know the work that you're doing with the podcast and documentary is a really great part of that. But I would like to see something, I don't know, maybe more written. And that's sort of my own bias as an instructor and as someone who likes to bring in popular culture figures to tell the unfamiliar side of their lives. I always tell my boss that I use familiar characters to tell unfamiliar stories. And I think that's sort of what Purdue and what you guys are doing really well. But I would like to see, you know, maybe even a little bit more so.
Andrew gave us some interesting thoughts there. Could Purdue do more when it comes to honoring Amelia Earhart's legacy? Do they position themselves intentionally in a certain way when it comes to the disappearance? We'll come back to those questions in a moment. Maybe he's right. After all, this show is about asking questions and gaining clarification. So who then do we bring these thoughts to? Who can give us insight into the role that Purdue plays in preserving her legacy? I think I need to call another president.
I think Amelia Earhart's spectacular life and career would have kept her relevant with or without Purdue, but no institution has anything close to the relationship or the history that we do with her.
Mitch Daniels became only the 12th president of Purdue University in January of 13. That was, of course, after the conclusion of his second term as Indiana's governor. At Purdue, President Daniels launched a series of initiatives called, quote, Purdue Moves, that provide bold answers to some of the greatest challenges facing higher education today. The four pillars of Purdue Moves are affordability and accessibility, transformative education, world-changing research, and STEM leadership. Those last two are going to be particularly important to tonight's show, and they'll tie into the world flight. Get that bow ready.
As I'm talking to you, I'm looking at a photo that's been in my office since the first day of Amelia Earhart on our campus with the then president, President Elliott, who brought her here in 1935. From then till the end of her life, this was her closest association. We are the library that has all her memorabilia and papers. And we've had a number of scholars work over the decades on sharing her story with others.
A little exposition if you haven't figured it out already. Of all the associations we've discussed in this show thus far, perhaps no other looms larger over Amelia's life than her relationship with Purdue. As President Daniels will soon tell us, Amelia took her role there very seriously. This wasn't a publicity stunt for her. This was the opportunity that she had been waiting for all her life. When then-Purdue President Edward C. Elliott brought AE into the fold, he was granting her a platform to do what she so cared about doing, and that was to educate, influence, and inspire. She saw that opportunity as a once-in-a-lifetime, and we all know what Amelia Earhart does with once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, don't we?
Purdue University has been at the forefront of a lot of important social transformations and phenomena. Another example is teaching international students goes back over a century here. It's not a recent phenomenon. And both educating young women and preparing them for careers, and beyond that, frequently for careers in what today we call STEM disciplines, has a very long track record here. And President Elliott was certainly way back in the 30s interested in that. He heard her lecture on the subject of women after college, was so impressed, brought her here, hired her, and of course then we supported her research and her personal aviation career the rest of her life. Purdue University was the only university in the country, it's still one of only a couple, had its own full airport, then as now, one of the finest aeronautics research and teaching colleges in the departments in the world. And so it was a very natural fit. And she, and of course the school was enthusiastic about her, raised outside money in fact to support her research, including the flight on which she was lost.
This was a mutually beneficial working relationship, and President Elliott had the good foresight to recognize that. The prospect of advising at Purdue excited Amelia on a whole new scope. Neither party saw this as a publicity stunt, but instead a way to inspire both men and women to follow the path that Amelia laid out, or perhaps even more importantly, create their own path.
I have to believe that it was an extraordinarily forward-looking activity on his part, or action on his part. Had to be seen that way. She was such an outstanding a person. If she were achieving equivalent feats today, I think she'd be a celebrity. But just imagine this in the 1930s, when even those women who were attending schools like Purdue tended to return to the home afterward. So, of course, she was very extraordinary, would have been in any epoch, but certainly then.
The Amelia Earhart statue at Purdue refers to her as, quote, an inspirer of dreams. I couldn't say it better myself. I wondered if Amelia felt then what her statue there reflects now. So I asked President Daniels to educate me.
I think she must have had some sense of it. After all, it could not have escaped her attention that she was a unique figure, an in-demand figure. I, having read now so much about her, including the memoirs of people who knew her well, I think like so many pioneer and leadership women, she would have wanted to see herself as an interesting and inspiring aviator first, woman behind that.
Often we make the mistake at Chasing Earhart of assuming that Amelia's reach was more targeted to women than anyone else. While that may be true, we tend to underestimate Amelia as simply being an icon for women. That would be amazing enough. But as President Daniels explains, Amelia was interested in reaching students, and it didn't particularly matter to her whether they were male or female. She was going for the biggest impact possible.
The building in which she lived while she was here is still here. I've been in it many, many times. And had a fairly small dining room, and she ate there apparently more often than not. And all our records show that she was students would angle for a chance to sit at her table. And my impression is this wasn't just our young women, but the young men were equally motivated by being around her. She wasn't at just any school that had lots of women in it. Then, as now, a higher percentage of our engineering, for instance, or aviation students were women than at other places. So it was not only that there were an unusual number of young females around, but many of them had the same general career interest she did.
It's important to note here that Purdue thought so much of their relationship with AE that they decided to get involved in her upcoming world flight by putting their money where their mouth was and financing her brand new state-of-the-art Lockheed Electra 10E. It's all starting to come together now.
But we are, and were at the time, a major research university. There was great interest here. I mean, her principal interest wasn't flying as a stunt. You know, it wasn't simply Lindbergh-type achievements. She really was interested in the physiological and psychological effects of long-distance flight. Much as we today and for a long time have studied the effects on humans of space flight. And that was really the what the money was raised for. That plane was described here as the flying laboratory. and she was taking it on long flights and carefully collecting data about what it meant to undergo the rigors, certainly then the rigors of long distance flights, sometimes different pressurization and so forth. So that's what it was about. That's really what the round the world flight was about pursuing learning, which of course is central to the mission of Purdue.
So listen to what President Daniels just said. Amelia was a scientist, really. This was a woman that not only wanted to fly for, quote, the fun of it, but she wanted to use aviation as a science to learn more about multiple aspects that continue to be taught and pursued today. She was an innovator. Add that to the list. I'm keeping count. One of my very favorite things to do when it comes to Amelia Earhart is to talk with my guests about the what-ifs. What would she have done if she had made it back safely from the world flight? How would her role with Purdue evolve? We never have a shortage of great answers to this question, so I had to ask President Daniels to weigh in here.
It is a fascinating question. I have to believe it would have gone on for a while because she would have come back with a wealth of new information and scientific understandings, which I'm quite certain that she and other scholars here would have translated for the benefit of the aviation industry as it was at the time. So I'd like to believe that it would have been a long-standing or continuing relationship. But she was a very independent-minded person, as we know, and might well have at some point veered off in a different direction. But everything we know from her many years here tells us that she really did enjoy the interaction with students and perhaps the motivation she provided them, and that we know for a certainty that she relished the companionship and the interactions with scholars, researchers, scientists in the area of aviation and aeronautics.
What I wasn't going to do is ask President Daniels what hypothesis he subscribed to regarding the disappearance. There will be plenty of that coming at us all real soon. But I was curious to learn about the fallout of the disappearance as it pertained to Purdue. After all, Purdue was most certainly the closest working relationship that AE had at the time. And perhaps more importantly, it represented Amelia's potential future after long-distance flight.
It hit much of America very hard. She was such a well-known figure at the time. No place harder than here. Again, we, as an entity, and so many people here knew her personally, more probably than any other place on the planet. And we had a very direct investment. That was that plane and the entire project, the mission, was a Purdue mission. If it's ever recovered, it belongs to us. I know that an event which struck home with millions of Americans and people outside the country probably had its epicenter right here at Purdue.
Purdue wants their plane back, and rightfully so. If you're an Earhart historian, author, or just a fan, you've either visited the archives at Purdue or you want to. As a matter of fact, if you visit their website, which we'll of course link to in tonight's show notes, you'll see a familiar image of Amelia Earhart on the splash page there. That's our logo for this program. The archives at Purdue contain the most glorious collection of Amelia Earhart material that you could ever lay your eyes on, plain and simple. Could that collection, someday, include a Lockheed Electra 10E? Well, you never know.
Over many years, Purdue or Boilermaker alums have contributed money to missions that have thought they had a chance to find out what happened, possibly retrieve the evidence, and maybe one day that'll happen. We are the repository of her, as I said, memorabilia, her papers, even poetry, I guess she had written some of, and her family placed it here, everything they had rights to. With the passage of time and the overdue engagement of women in so many careers, including aviation, her remarkable achievements and characteristics probably do need to be nurtured from time to time. And, you know, we see ourselves as custodians, stewards maybe, of her legacy. We are celebrating Purdue's 150th year this year. Coincidentally, by the way, it's the 50th anniversary of another of our alums, Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon in July of 1969. And so there'll be a lot of seminars and a lot of involvement in the courseware of our students this year about Amelia Earhart, who she was, what she did, and what her life meant.
We're almost there. Before we dive into one of the greatest and compelling historical mysteries of all time, I want to remind you all of how everything we've covered up to this point matters. As we go through this case, think about what Amelia meant to the collective conscience of the country, of aviation, and of dreamers everywhere. Amelia Earhart has had a career up to this point that can only be described as magical, and now she has a plan. To fly around the world at the equator, a task that only someone like A.E. could dream up. A challenge that many people think was a self-imposed death sentence. But as always, Amelia didn't see that. Amelia saw the struggle, the task, and the hope to continue to push herself to inspire as she had been doing her entire career. And now, thanks to Purdue, she had her plane. A plane that has gone down in history as the holy grail of aviation. Are you ready? Part 6 of Vanished Amelia Earhart is now behind us. I want to thank my guests Andrew McGregor and President Mitch Daniels for joining me tonight. As always, don't forget to check out the show notes for an expanded view of tonight's episode. I think I found what I was looking for here. Time to move on. See you next time.
This is Scott Thrower from the Fairy Tales for Unwanted Children podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished, Amelia Earhart. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media where our team posts all of our episodes as they air, news, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/vanishedAmeliaEarhart and on Twitter and Instagram search the handle VanishedAE. Reviews are critical to the show. If you've enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out. Vanished Amelia Earhart is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Chris Williamson. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished Amelia Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. Vanished Amelia Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc., and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2019. All rights reserved.